From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, our guests are James Trussell and Heather Boonstra. They'll be discussing emergency contraception, a safe and effective medication taken after unprotected sex that has the potential to prevent half the abortions in the U.S. We'll discuss the reasons why so few women are aware of this medication and why the federal government has not acted to promote public awareness of this beneficial treatment. Then, later in the show, we'll look at the pharmaceutical industry's effort to invent a new disease, female sexual dysfunction. But will this research benefit women? Dr. Leonore Tiefer will be joining us to examine the issue. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. On September 30th, the U.S. Census published its report on health insurance coverage in the U.S. for the year 2002. The number of individuals with no form of insurance coverage rose by 2.4 million. So 43.6 million Americans had no health insurance coverage during all of last year, the highest number ever reported, and also the highest percentage of the U.S. population reported in decades to lack insurance. The entire decline in insurance coverage was due to a drop in employment-based private health insurance coverage, which is now down to 55% of the population. There was a modest increase in the number of individuals covered through the Medicaid program, but this did not come close to compensating for the number of individuals who lost private health insurance coverage. New Mexico, one of the states with the worst track record on insurance coverage, was the only state where the health insurance situation improved. This left Texas with the highest proportion of individuals without insurance. 25% of Texans had no health insurance coverage last year. 11.6% of children lacked health insurance coverage, a percentage which did not worsen last year, presumably due to the Children's Health Insurance Program passed in 1997. Over 30% of individuals whose incomes fall below the poverty line have no form of health insurance. The percentage for the population as a whole is now up to 15.2%. Virtually all minority groups fare worse than whites. 20% of blacks and 1/3 of Hispanics were uninsured all of last year. The worsening in insurance coverage is greatest among part-time workers and those who didn't work, but was also prominent among full-time workers. And 70% of people working in small businesses with fewer than 25 employees did not have health insurance provided by their employer last year. The likelihood of having health insurance rises with income, but health insurance coverage worsened among all income groups and all educational levels last year. Almost the entire deterioration in insurance coverage in the year 2002 occurred among individuals between ages 18 and 44. This was especially true among the young adults. 30% of 18 to 24-year-olds had no form of health insurance coverage during all of 2002. This report is available at the website of the U.S. Census, which is census.gov. In the year 2000, the Department of Health and Human Services released a set of goals for public health to achieve by the year 2010. The Oregon Health Sciences Center and the National Women's Law Center just released a report reviewing the progress toward those goals in the area of tobacco smoking among women and tobacco-related state policies. The overall goal was to reduce smoking rates among women to less than 12%. Utah is the only state which has achieved that goal, with the nation as a whole averaging just above 20% of women smoking. Women in New York and Vermont are doing a bit worse than the nation as a whole, but hidden in that overall statistic is the fact that smoking rates among younger women have continued an upward trend, far higher than for the nation as a whole. For example, more than 30% of white high school girls smoke. And among white women aged 18 to 24, Vermont and New York State are doing much worse than the national average. 36% of 18 to 24-year-old women in Vermont smoke, and just under 40% in New York. So given the high addictive potential of tobacco smoking, the future of tobacco-related death and disability in New York and Vermont is quite ominous. Despite the tobacco settlement, which gave a large amount of money for states to use to counter tobacco use, spending on tobacco cessation activities directed to the public still amount to only 6% of what the industry spends to encourage smoking. The report is accessible to web browsers at nwlc.org, the website of the National Women's Law Center. Coming up next, emergency contraception. So stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Today's show is addressing issues of reproductive health. The discussions will include allusions to sex and contraceptive technology, though only briefly, so parents who are concerned about their children hearing such a discussion can act accordingly. Due to the nature of media coverage of the abortion issue, abortion is commonly seen in the U.S. as a white and black issue. One is either opposed to most or all abortions, or one supports a woman's right to make all decisions over her body, including the abortion decision. Rarely do we hear discussions about strategies that could reduce the number of abortions. Each year in the U.S., at least 2 to 3 million unintended pregnancies occur, and about 1 million of these result in abortion. Emergency contraception is a medication that is taken within 3 days after intercourse when there is a suspected failure of contraception. Despite its track record of minimal side effects and about 88% effectiveness at preventing pregnancy, emergency contraception has received virtually no publicity in the U.S., and little more than 10% of women of reproductive age are familiar with it. Most experts estimate that 500,000 of the 1 million abortions that occur in the U.S. each year would be prevented if knowledge of emergency contraception were widespread and if the medication were readily available at all pharmacies. Joining us today to discuss emergency contraception are Heather Boonstra and James Trussell. Heather Boonstra is a senior policy associate at the Alan Guttmacher Institute. She earned a master's degree in religion and medical ethics from Yale University and has worked as a consultant in international population and family planning with the Center for International Health and Information. James Trussell is professor of economics and public affairs and director of the Office of Population Research at Princeton University. He is the author of nearly 200 scientific publications, primarily in the areas of reproductive health and demographic methodology, and emergency contraception has been one important research focus. He has also actively promoted making emergency contraception more widely available as an important step in reducing the incidence of unintended pregnancy and the need for abortion. He maintains an emergency contraception website, nottoolate.com, and designed and launched a toll-free emergency contraception hotline, 1-888-NOT-TOO-LATE. For interested listeners, those references will be available at our website, publichealthradio.org. James Trussell and Heather Boonstra, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
For listeners who don't know much about contraception, or in particular, emergency contraception, I'm wondering if you could define what it is and what that means in comparison to the morning after pill, which some people may know about.
Sure. Emergency contraceptives are regular contraceptives used in a different way to prevent pregnancy after sexual intercourse. Sometimes they're called morning after pills, but this term is really quite misleading because some people will think from that description that they can't be used until the morning after, whereas in fact they can be used immediately after unprotected sex. And other people think that they can't be used beyond the morning after, when in fact they can be used up to 5 days after unprotected sex.
Is emergency contraception
equally effective if it's used immediately, for example, after, say, breakage of a condom or unprotected sexual relations, or does it become less effective with time? Can you talk about overall effectiveness?
Yeah, there are two kinds of emergency contraceptive pills available in the United States. One is just like a regular birth control pill that contains both estrogen and progestin, and that will prevent about 75% of pregnancies that otherwise would have occurred. The second method is a birth control pill that contains only the hormone progestin, and that will prevent about 88% of pregnancies that otherwise would have occurred. Now, that doesn't mean that if you prevent 75% of pregnancies, then 25% of people get pregnant. In fact, if 100 women have unprotected sex once in the second or third week of their cycle and do nothing, about 8 will get pregnant. If they take combined emergency contraceptive pills, 2 would become pregnant, so that's a reduction from 8 to 2 or 75%. And then if they take the progestin-only emergency contraceptive pill, 1 will become pregnant. That's a reduction of from 8 to 1 or 88%.
And when James is talking about this, he's talking about the use of these methods within about a 72-hour time frame. There's also research shows that if used within the first 24 hours, that effectiveness actually increases. So it is true that effectiveness is that the emergency contraception is most effective when used earlier.
So women are taking higher doses of hormones than of the, really the same hormones that are taken in regular oral contraceptives. So can you talk about the side effect profile? Are there disturbing effects from the medicine?
Sure. There have now been literally scores of clinical trials of emergency contraceptive pills. And so we have a fairly good understanding of what the safety issues are. There are no long-term or serious side effects that have been reported in the literature. There are, however, short-term side effects, the main one being nausea and vomiting. With combined emergency contraceptive pills, about 50% of people get nauseated and about 20% vomit. But their other side effects include breast tenderness, headaches, and so forth. But these are temporary and go away shortly, and most people don't experience them at all. With the progestin-only pill, the side effect profile is much better. It's superior to the combined pill, both because it has fewer side effects and because it's more effective.
Why does the estrogen, the product that includes the estrogen, remain on the market if it has poorer efficacy and more side effects? It seems kind of odd.
Well, in some countries, the dedicated product has actually been taken off the market. In the United Kingdom, for example, there is no combined emergency contraceptive pill anymore, and the progestin-only one has really taken over. But in the United States, not everybody has access to the progestin-only pill, and taking the combined pill is certainly a lot better than taking nothing. The other thing to remember is that there are 17 brands of regular oral contraception, the pills that you take every day for contraception, that can be used for emergency contraception. So it some women have access to those regular birth control pills who don't have access to the dedicated products.
So in other words, a woman who has a pack of oral contraceptive pills could potentially just call their doctor or their nurse practitioner and ask them how to take them after the fact if they're concerned.
Or they can go to the emergency contraception website and they can find out how to take. We have listed for each country in the world the pills that can be used for emergency contraception by brand and how many pills of what color one takes.
And it would seem to me that emergency contraception with efficacy rates as in excess of 75% would be an enormously effective technique to prevent unintended pregnancy, which is, of course, why it's there. And I guess I would like to know if it's actually what actually impact it really actually has in the real world and on unintended pregnancy in the United States, maybe compared to other countries?
Well, I think that emergency contraception has the potential to reduce unintended pregnancy significantly. In fact, we've estimated that up to one half of unintended pregnancies could be prevented if, in fact, emergency contraception were widely available and widely used. We're nowhere near reaching that potential. Only 6% of women in the United States have ever used emergency contraception, but one in two women have had an unintended pregnancy. So the main barrier to reaching the potential is that women simply don't know about it.
Yeah, and I would agree with James. And the only data that we have on its actual impact, you know, based on the small percentage of women who have used emergency contraception, is from the Alan Guttmacher Institute. We did conduct a study, actually two surveys, both of abortion providers and then of about 10,000 women having abortions in the United States. And we asked them about their contraceptive use and discovered that, about 51,000 abortions had been averted by women's use of emergency contraception. And that, in fact, emergency contraception accounted for 43% of the decrease in total abortions between 1994 and 2000. So, already we're beginning to see that there are fewer abortions because of emergency contraception. But just as James has said, its potential certainly has not been realized.
You know, those data, I can't think of a more appropriate use of the term is the glass half empty or is the glass half full, because you're talking about the decrease in the number of abortions has actually been modest. And there's 1 million abortions every year. You're estimating that this contraceptive decreased about 4%. So that in some ways is very small. But on the other hand, of the decrease in the total number of pregnancies, emergency contraception accounts for a hefty portion of that improvement. So depending on how you look at it, it's a tremendous success or is far from realizing its potential. How do you see this problem?
Well, I think that we have made a lot of progress in the last decade. But we have a long way to go. And again, the hardest part is just letting women know that there is something that can be done after intercourse to prevent pregnancy. What you have here, the two dedicated products on the market are both distributed, each of them, by sort of the world's smallest pharmaceutical company. They simply they're not big enough to do any real promotion. The progestin-only product is now being considered by the Food and Drug Administration to go over the counter. There's no medical reason why it should not, and so I expect it to go over the counter within the next year. But that in and of itself is not going to cause women to know that it exists. It will be a tremendous help to women who know about it, and it will reduce the barriers to getting it just to be able to go to a drugstore and buy it. But it's not in and of itself going to educate the rest of the women in America, the majority of women in America, who don't really know about emergency contraception.
And that's true. There have been studies done looking at women's awareness, and especially when you compare it to Europe, where emergency contraception has been approved for longer. In Europe, there are indications that 75 or up to 95% of women are aware that emergency contraception is available to them, whereas in the United States, only 51% of women of reproductive age say there is something that they can do after intercourse to prevent pregnancy. And yet, of that 51% even, many don't know that emergency contraception is available in the United States by prescription. And a lot of them, as we sort of said at the onset, a lot of them confuse it with the abortion pill or RU-46 or mifepristone. That's a different drug altogether with a different ingredient list than emergency contraception.
So it sounds like you're saying that one of the big limitations is educational, is getting the word out that effective contraception exists after the sexual act and not just beforehand. So
it's not one of the biggest problems. It is the biggest problem.
Yeah, and in fact, women themselves are sort of caught in this vicious cycle where they don't hear it from their providers. So, and their providers themselves are waiting for the women to ask them about the drug. And so there isn't much communication going on between an OBGYN, say, and a woman. And at the same time, then pharmacies are not stocking the drug because women are not coming into the pharmacies to actually fill their prescriptions because they don't know the method exists. So what we have also found is that women who have their prescriptions in hand have trouble filling the prescription just because they, you know, none of the pharmacies have these on their shelves. So there's this, you know, between the pharmacist, the provider, and the woman, there's just, you know, general non-communication and has really prevented the use of this drug.
I think when you're talking about providers of contraceptive care, I assume that there's two large groups. One are regular OBGYN practitioners and other allied health professionals, nurse practitioners who work with them. And then the other would be all the Planned Parenthood organizations across the country. Am I correct that those would be the main providers here?
Well, a third source is a non-family planning, but just regular family practice physicians.
Okay. And have those three groups taken this on? Have there been surveys of those groups as to whether they know about this and whether they believe it to be effective and whether they're talking about it with patients?
Oh, yeah. The Kaiser Family Foundation has done periodic surveys of providers. First of all, I should say that Planned Parenthood clinics, almost without exception, dispense emergency contraception. So there is a very easy place to go. Most OBGYNs will provide emergency contraception. But again, as Heather said, they're waiting for women to come in to ask about it, and only about 20% of them routinely discuss emergency contraception with their clients. So, a barrier is simply not discussing in advance with clients, and it's easy to understand. There's a limited time and an appointment and many things to cover. Another group that provides emergency contraception is emergency room physicians after a sexual assault.
And how do they do overall? Is that known?
One big barrier is that a lot of emergency rooms are operated by the Catholic Church, and there is limited provision of emergency contraception in emergency rooms operated by the Church.
And that's right. And in order to address that, actually, there have been a number of states, I think seven at this point, that actually have passed legislation in order to address this problem. So they are requiring emergency rooms within their state to either offer or refer or provide emergency contraception to women who have been sexually assaulted. There's also legislation that's been introduced at the federal level, but this really hasn't moved in Congress at this point.
Now, since there's a huge deficit in both providers and the population as a whole in terms of knowing about the availability of emergency contraception, do you think that there is an appropriate role for government or other public organizations in getting this information to the public that this technology exists?
Well, absolutely. And in fact, this provision through emergency rooms as required by some states is one way of addressing that. Another way of addressing that is through general education campaigns about emergency contraception. And there has been other federal legislation introduced in order to spur the Centers for Disease Control to mount that kind of campaign. And actually, when you ask voters if they would support government involvement, there was a survey conducted in 2002 by Peter Hart Research Associates, and they found that two-thirds of voters think that government involvement in this area is an important thing. And one of the things that those voters pointed to was just the very fact that women, that this method is most effective within that 72-hour window. And so women need to know before they encounter a situation where they need emergency contraception. They need to know that the method is available to them. They can't, you know, within that 72 hours, you know, can't learn about it and get it, and, you know, that's just too complicated. So this idea of government involvement is something that that also has voter support.
The average person, at least in my experience, having worked on this for more than a decade, most people, when they find out about emergency contraception, their reaction is one of anger. Why didn't I know about this before? I mean, this is a no-brainer. They're mad that that this existed and they didn't know about it. There's one other type of legislation that has been helpful in this regard. 20 states now have laws that mandate that contraception be covered to the same extent as other prescription drugs and devices are covered by medical plans. So that's enabled women in these states who know about emergency contraception to get it covered through their health insurance.
That would be for all contraceptive technologies.
Correct.
But that still doesn't get people to know that emergency contraception exists for after the sexual act.
That's correct.
And I guess I've lived in upstate New York and Vermont and have spent time elsewhere, and I have seen no promotion either by a company producing the technology. I've seen no promotion by any private agency or any government agency that this exists. I have never seen a media spot either as an ad or as part of a news program, ever.
Well, that's right. I mean, I definitely understand that. We have run campaigns about emergency contraception in six cities, but that's all the funding that we had.
The government's already spending tremendous amounts of money on reproductive health, and it seems to me that abortion is such a critical concern to so many people. Why isn't the federal government doing much, much more? And it just surprises me that it's not even reaching 20% of its potential. Try to help me understand why our governmental policy is not, it doesn't seem to be there.
Well, you're right. It doesn't seem to match up to the potential of emergency contraception. And I think that there are really two reasons. One is an overarching reason that the federal government isn't investing dollars in greater access to contraceptives overall. Title X funding, which is the federal funding for family planning in the United States, that's been flatlined for a number of years. And rather than put dollars into contraception as a whole, the area that is getting more money is abstinence-only education, which only teaches abstinence outside of marriage for people of all ages. So I think that's one reason. I think another reason, though, is a kind of confusion of emergency contraception in the public's eye with the abortion pill, RU486. And these are two different drugs altogether. But I think that there's a general confusion among the public that actually makes them think that emergency contraception is the abortion pill. And I think that social conservatives in Congress have really capitalized on this to really say that emergency contraception is tantamount to abortion, and therefore the government shouldn't be funding activities that involve abortion at all. So I think that's another reason why there are two bills actually that have been introduced in Congress, and they have not moved at all in terms of the congressional agenda.
So it sounds fairly dismal. Like you're saying that the current federal administration feel doesn't support emergency contraception? I guess I don't understand. Why wouldn't they want to act to prevent half the abortions that are occurring? That would seem to not be controversial. I don't get it.
I don't think that it would be controversial. You would have to ask them. To me, it's a no-brainer. We thought so all along.
And what is the religious objection stems from people who think there should be no premarital sexuality at all, so they don't want to facilitate any form of contraception. Is that the idea?
That's one objection. Another objection is from those who believe that emergency contraception is abortion, when of course it's not.
Well, I was wondering if you could direct interested listeners to websites where they can learn more about both the technology of how one goes about getting emergency contraception and using it, and the more the policy issues about why more people don't know about it and it seems to be so underutilized.
Sure. We operate here at Princeton University in conjunction with the Association of Reproductive Health Professionals, both a hotline and a website. The hotline number is 1-888-NOT-TOO-LATE. That's the digit 2, so it's N-O-T, the digit 2, late. And we run the emergency contraception website at nottoolate.com. That's not-the-digit-2-late.com. Both of these are completely automated, available 24 hours a day. The website is available in English, Spanish, French, and Arabic. The hotline is available in English and Spanish. And in addition to providing information about emergency contraception, we also maintain a directory of providers now numbering about 4,000 who have signed up and say that they will provide emergency contraception. When one calls the hotline, it's very smart, and it will give you, if you choose this option, the 5 providers located nearest to the phone from which you're calling. And if you call from one of the 5 states where one can get emergency contraception directly from a pharmacist, then you will also get a list of the 5 pharmacies. If you go to the phone you're calling from, and if you go to the website, you can search any number of ways. You can find providers nearest to your area code, nearest to your zip code, by city and state, or many other ways.
For those interested in policy issues or more background and context or even an update of state laws in this area, they can go to the Alan Guttmacher Institute's website at guttmacher.org. That's guttmacher.org.
Well, Heather Boonstra and James Trussell, I'd like to thank you for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us indeed.
The Emergency Contraception Education Act was introduced in both the House and Senate in March of 2002. In both houses, the leadership froze the bill, and no vote has yet occurred in either House of Congress. Both our guests encourage listeners to contact their congressional representatives to support this legislation. Further details are available at our website, publichealthradio.org. I did take up Dr. Trussell on his suggestion to ask representatives of the Bush administration to comment on their lack of support for emergency contraception. After numerous phone calls and many conversations with several press officers, no one was ultimately made available to comment on this issue for Public Health Radio. Coming up next, the pharmaceutical industry's effort to manufacture a disease, female sexual dysfunction, with the goal of marketing a female version of Viagra that could lead to comparable profitability. But will the benefits of this research outweigh the risks? Dr. Leonore Tiefer joins us to discuss the issue, so stay tuned. the remarkable financial success of drugs used to treat impotence in men, the pharmaceutical industry turned its attention to women, seeking a drug to treat women's sexual problems that might be as profitable as Viagra. Unfortunately, these drug company researchers immediately ran into a significant problem. There was no defined sexual disease state in women that was comparable to male impotence. This, however, did not deter them. Rather than attempt to hone in on a specific problem, these drug industry researchers simply came up with a diagnosis that could handle most any female sexual problem that might arise. The new disease state was termed female sexual dysfunction. The question is whether this diagnosis exists in the real world and whether the benefits of such drugs that might be developed will outweigh the psychic and physical side effects. Joining us today to discuss this new disease label of female sexual dysfunction is Leonor Tiefer. Dr. Tiefer received her PhD in experimental psychology at the University of California at Berkeley. She then moved to New York City, where she has worked in clinical psychiatry, both in private practice and in academic settings, initially at NYU and currently at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, where she now serves as a clinical associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry. Her many research publications focus on human sexuality, including several on female sexual dysfunction, the topic of today's discussion. Leonor Tiefer, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Hi, Marv. Good to talk to you.
Could you give our listeners a bit of history and a context for the development of this new diagnosis of female sexual dysfunction?
Yeah, you know, usually when you think of a new diagnosis, you think, well, it must come out of some new scientific research, and people have found diseases, conditions that they didn't know exist, or maybe something new entered the picture, like a new allergy because there's some new things that cause allergies. But this female sexual dysfunction thing, I think, comes about in actually neither of those ways. I think it's a political development, really, much more than a scientific development. And I think it came about really shortly after Viagra was approved for men's erection problems, that Viagra was such an incredible success in terms of a profit center for Pfizer, and that the whole pharmaceutical industry kind of opened its eyes and looked around and said, gee, you know, if we did this well with men, maybe there's something comparable we could do with women. But it isn't so clear, really, what would be a comparable problem. So this sort of umbrella term, female sexual dysfunction, started getting used to sort of include everything that might go wrong with women's sexual experience, both the functional part, you know, what happens in the body, and their own subjective enjoyment, their desire, their whole evaluation of the experience, really anything that you might think of as a sexual problem has been sort of shoehorned into this notion of female sexual dysfunction, but it's really quite unclear. And to me, it's one sign of how vague and confusing it is, in that the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, that approves new drugs, doesn't yet have a clear handle on what it is. And I think that's one reason why no drugs have been approved for this, because the FDA can't figure out really how it's going to evaluate whether any new drugs are safe and effective. So it's a vague term that is getting a lot of promotion, but I think since it doesn't have a lot to do with science and it has more to do with politics, it's kind of vague.
You're using the term politics, but I'm getting the feeling that it's actually commercial. This is a commercial phenomenon. So is it primarily the drug industry? Like, is that the main financial impetus behind this?
Yes, it is. The financial impetus comes from the drug industry, but there are a lot of physicians that are behind this as well. That could be new career opportunities for these physicians. it's not just the pharmaceutical industry, but I do think the money is coming from the pharmaceutical industry.
There's not any drugs yet that have been proposed for this?
There's nothing approved for the treatment of female sexual dysfunction, whatever that is, except this device, a kind of vibrator suction device that's very expensive, $359. And since you don't have to go through the same hoops to get a device approved that you do to get a drug approved, it was easy to get that device approved. You don't have to go through, you know, a lot of tests about safety and efficacy and so on as being helpful to women's sexual experience. But there's no drug or cream or gel or inhalant or patch or anything like that approved yet. But they're all under development. They're coming right along.
Can you talk a little bit about the type of analysis that the drug companies and these researchers that are promoting this new diagnosis of female sexual dysfunction, what type of analysis are they using? How do they look at female sexuality?
They look at it primarily in a functional way, in a what I might call a mechanical way, although I think they probably would object to that term. They've divided this female sexual dysfunction into specific categories of problems with genital arousal and orgasm, and also any kind of genital pain, although I think that's sort of a separate thing. I think anybody who has any pain with sex definitely has a problem, and I definitely think they should be treated, and we don't know enough about that. But the lion's share, actually, of the energy behind the new drugs isn't in the pain area. I mean, but the way that drug companies think about sexuality is primarily this arousal and orgasm thing, that as if that were the necessary and sufficient conditions for women's sexual satisfaction. Now, I think the reason they focus on that is that it's fairly easy to take a drug that affects genital experience. You smear some testosterone gel on, the chances are your genital experience will change. But there's a lot of research on women's sexuality that suggests genital experience is not a primary concern. It's not at the top of the list. It's neither necessary nor sufficient in the research we have for women's sexual satisfaction. I'm not saying it's irrelevant, but there are other things that are regarded as much more important, like tenderness and respect and a woman having a good mental health and a good attitude about her body, and situational things like privacy and time and a lack of feeling pressure. I mean, all of those kinds of things are shown by research to be much more necessary for women's sexual satisfaction. But the drug company comes along and says, oh, yeah, yeah, I mean, we believe in all that stuff, tenderness. Oh, that's cool. But, you know, that's not sex. That's like, you know, that's the context. That's romance or something. That's not what we deal with. We fix genital problems. Now, that may make sense on one level, but on another level, they're actually promoting a change in women's priorities, I think, through a lot of their publicity and a lot of the research, and when there are these products, through the advertisements for the products, they're going to promote the idea that a woman who doesn't have a strong, routine, reliable, predictable genital experience is sexually inadequate and should have a diagnosis and should take some treatment. And I really object to that. So that's, you know, to make a long story short, the reason I think the focus of the pharmaceutical industry is really not to deal with the issues that women themselves complain about, but to create a new standard for women's sexual experience, one that they can then have a product available for.
In your one sentence where you talked about the problems, some of the potential problems with this approach, it occurred to me that there were two very different and both important ramifications. One is that women who had actually felt okay about their life or about their relationship, perhaps, now might come to see themselves as dysfunctional or diseased and be tempted to start on medication, which might then have side effects and harm them.
Absolutely. You hit the nail on the head. That is one main reason I'm upset about this. Press on.
Yeah, it seemed to me the other is the fact that it would encourage women to not look at underlying issues in relationships, perhaps.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right, too. Women and their partners and their doctors. Let's just add that part, that if the focus becomes, do you have the proper sensation in your labia or in your clitoris or in the outer part of your vagina, and let's test that and let's measure that and let's develop a whole lot of measurement equipment to make sure that you have proper muscle tone and proper blood flow, you can do a whole number in terms of distracting people from thinking about what other issues might be going on that might be contributing. And sooner or later, of course, everybody can find something about their genitalia that could be remedied or fixed or changed. And so, yes, then you do start people taking all kinds of drugs that might indeed have consequences. I really feel that, and I have to say this, I'm a sex therapist, right, as I'm a clinical psychologist who specializes in sexual problems, and I've seen, hundreds and actually thousands of people over the years I've been doing this, and people's knowledge and comfort in the area of sexuality is not very great. And everybody could use a little education, I think, in terms of knowing more about how sexual arousal actually occurs, or even in knowing that pleasure is available, intimacy is available from so many different ways than genital activity. So people need to know more about how the genitalia work in that whole system, but they also need to know more about pleasure. And they're not going to learn enough from this whole new medicalization phase. They're going to be distracted by all of the sort of bells and whistles of all of this new measurement stuff, and that's already going on in these new sex clinics where they're measuring blood flow to the this and the that, and they're measuring hormone levels, even though there are no norms established for women's testosterone levels, how much normal women have who don't have any sexual problems, even though that isn't yet established. Still, everybody who comes in gets blood tests and so on. So women are going to get distracted by all of this medical stuff. They're not going to have to learn more about their own response and their own desires and maybe read some things or learn some more things. Their partners aren't going to be involved at all. The whole thing is just going to become medicalized. I think a terrible wasted opportunity, really.
What other dangers do you think might come from this more mechanistic approach to female sexuality?
Well, there's, errors of omission and errors of commission, as I think of it. The errors of commission, the problems are going to be that we're going to create a lot of insecurity, as you mentioned. We're going to overprescribe, and with all the dangers surrounding that. And we're going to create a generation, or maybe even permanent change, in terms of women's focus on their genitalia as the key elements of sexual satisfaction, the way men are now focused on their erection. I mean, how did men get to be so obsessed with their erection? This is a long story and not a great one. I don't think it's a happy situation that men are so obsessed with their erections. And I would just hate to see women get obsessed with their clitoris or their labia or their vagina or their lubrication or is it hot enough or that kind of stuff. There's no obvious structure like the penis for women to get focused on, but I could see it happening. I could see women getting as obsessed with the clitoris as men are with their penis in a physical kind of a way. So those would be errors of commission. And then the errors of omission, things that are not being studied, not being paid attention to, are all of the reasons I think women are sexually unhappy, not really being free in their relationships to express what they want, or being put down for wanting, like cuddling. You remember when, was it Dear Abby or somebody said, you know, would you rather have intercourse or cuddling? And 75,000 women wrote in, and something like 75% or 80% of them said they'd rather have cuddling. And people said, well, but that's not sex. You know, let's get real here. You want sex? So the idea is women are not free to get what they want, to express what they want. They're told it's not sex, or it's not the right kind of sex, or something like that. So I feel that errors of omission in terms of women's sexual emancipation, if I could use a really big word, are going to come about because of this sort of steamroller of medicalization. Lost opportunities for diversity. I think the medicalization is a kind of one-size-fits-all sexuality. You know, everybody's got to have the genital arousal and the orgasm, intercourse, that's the essential activity. Anything else is foreplay or variety. But basically, you know, real sex, we all know what real sex is. So that's a very standardized model. And I think that that kind of standardized, intercourse-centered model is being perpetuated by this medicalization. And I feel like that's a sad narrowing of the human potential. It's as if we all had to love opera. You know, and anybody who didn't love opera was not interested in real music. You know, yeah, you know, you can play country and western every once in a while, but you must go to the real opera. No, that's not how we view music. We view music as, you know, variety is the spice of life, but we don't view sex that way. And I think that this kind of medicalization is going to make that narrowing and standardization even worse. So that's kind of how I look at the dangers.
Now, I treat a lot of men in my medical practice.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of them come in asking for Viagra or complaining about problems with erections. And I always ask, if they're coming in asking for a prescription for Viagra, I always ask them if they've discuss this with their partner, and it astonishes me. Even men who've been married for 30 years or 40 years, that they haven't talked it over. Mm-hmm. And they don't know how their partner feels about it. And then I have this other experience where I leave the room and there's this wife out there, or I get a call a few days later later that same day with the wife saying, are you sure that there's not some medical reason why my husband should not be taking Viagra, with the basically asking me to not prescribe it. And it just, the poor communication sometimes just astonishes me. And I guess, in fact, I was thinking that with this new medical model of female sexual dysfunction, all of these women would actually be considered diseased.
Because they weren't interested in resuming sex with Viagra.
Right. They don't want their husbands rejuvenated. They don't want it.
Yeah. You know, without talking to these women at length, you may be coming to the wrong conclusion. I saw thousands, literally. I kept records of men in a urology clinic, who almost all of whom came in alone initially for treatment for their erectile problems throughout the 80s and 90s. And I would try to get them to bring their partners in, and I succeeded a substantial amount of the time. I don't remember how much, let's say about a third of the time, but that was a lot of women. And some of them expressed, well, they expressed views from A to Z. You know, some of them would say, you know, get him fixed. I can hardly wait. Let's get back in the saddle. It's the thing I love the best. And then at the other end of the spectrum, there would be, I hated it. He was never any good at it. Do me a favor. Let's not have any more of this. But then we would have all sorts of other kinds of views, like the ones you expressed. Will this hurt him in any way? Intercourse isn't that important to me. Yes, I would like it. But, you know, this guy takes antihypertensives, or he's diabetic, or he's had this, that, and the other. And I'm telling you, I will worry about him, and it will interfere with my ability to be absorbed in a sexual encounter. Now, if I could reassure these women that this was a safe drug and nothing bad was going to happen, and really considering all the other things that their husband was taking, it wasn't a problem, then these women were often positive, you know, enthusiastic even, willing to try it. But they needed a lot of reassurance because, you know, they felt sex was a very active thing and it was dangerous and the husband was taking other drugs and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, that kind of conversation could go two different ways, you know, for the woman who really didn't want to resume sex or the woman who really did.
Those are really interesting points. I'm wondering if you could recommend a website or two for listeners who'd like to learn more about this issue. A little further?
Well, you know, there's I can recommend a couple of websites. One is if people want to know more about this sort of political anti-medicalization perspective that I'm putting forward. It comes from a group of us, actually. We call ourselves the Campaign for a New View of Women's Sexual Problems, and we have a website which is FSD, as in female sexual dysfunction, FSD-alert.org. And then if people want to know just more about sexuality, I would direct them to a site that I think has fabulous information and also fabulous links. And that's the website of the Sexuality Information Education Council of the U.S. And their website is their initials, SIECUS.org.
Well, Leonore Tiefer, I'd like to thank you for having joined us on Public Health Radio.
Well, I appreciate it, Marvin. I had a good time, and you asked me some questions I hadn't thought of before. I appreciate that.
Thanks again. Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune in to any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.